Hello, and welcome to Unlocking Games, a show about social impact games and how they provide a new way to explain the things you care about. I'm Chad Haefeli. I work with user experience in academic libraries.
And I'm Brandon Carper, a training designer.
And welcome to our big, spectacular 24th episode extravaganza. Woo!
That's a number of people. Oh, it's two dozen, right? Chad.
Yes, two dozen. That's all you could make 24 eggs with two dozen eggs.
If we were donuts, we would be in two boxes.
I'm hungry now. Thank you.
Exactly.
I don't know how to segue out of that into our topic this week. But
I thought I'd make it easy for you.
Yeah, you know, from donuts to the Syrian Civil War. Here we go.
Oh, so, well, that was a left turn.
Yeah, but we'll run with it. So this week we're going to be talking about a game that is clearly tied to a bunch of things that have been in the headlines recently, although the game predates some of those headlines itself. As you may be aware, the Syrian Civil War has been going on for about 5 years now. And according to a recent summary from Al Jazeera, there's been 450,000 Syrians killed in the fighting, more than a million injured, and over 12 million Syrians, that's half the country's pre-war population, have been displaced from their homes. So, pretty disruptive.
That boggles my mind.
Yeah, I know. Like, at some point, the numbers become meaningless. At some point, like, I can't even picture half a million people.
Well, I think what drives it home for me is the phrase, half of the country's pre-war population. So if you imagine one out of every two people you have ever known in the United States and think that their house has been destroyed or they've had to leave where they live, that's what boggles my mind.
So what are there, 300 something million people in the U.S. right now?
There are a lot of people.
Yeah, so I mean, scale that up and it's almost literally unimaginable to try and figure out what this actually means. And then even more recently, of course, there's been President Trump's executive order way back on January 27th. It feels like ages ago, but it was but a mere 16 or 17 days at this point. Direct quote from it, "I hereby proclaim that the entry of nationals of Syria as refugees is detrimental to the interests of the United States, and thus suspend any such entry until such time as I have determined that sufficient changes have been made to the United States refugee admissions program to ensure that admission of Syrian refugees is consistent with the national interest." That's a direct quote taken from a reading of the order on NPR. So, no more Syrian refugees coming to the U.S. Not that our doors were ever wide open in the first place. I mean, it's not like we were taking those 12 million people in.
Yeah, we did have some vetting procedures in place that made a pretty narrow funnel, from what I understand.
Yeah, I've seen some news stories about a couple of families who landed locally here, but it's definitely... it's a couple of families. It's not anywhere near the 12 million that have been displaced from their homes.
Sure. And I think one of the reasons why this order caused such an outcry was because it just totally 100% shut the door, albeit nominally, temporarily, on people running from this country.
Yeah, including those who were already on the way here.
Correct.
Who had been gone through the vetting process and everything like that. But we're not here to debate the politics of it. That's been covered pretty much extensively elsewhere.
Yeah, I don't know, Chad. Has that been in the news?
You know, if only the media would cover these stories, then I could be more informed about things one of these days. But there's a clear connection between this ongoing, both the executive order and the Syrian Civil War itself, and the game we're talking about this week, which is called This War of Mine. I keep wanting to call it This Little War of Mine for some reason.
Maybe that gives it the wrong connotation.
Yeah, perhaps. There's no little. It is This War of Mine.
You're not going to hide it under a bushel, probably.
No, a very large bushel, perhaps. The tagline of the game is, "In war, not everyone is a soldier." So it was released in November 2014, which makes it a little over 2 years old at this point. So the Syrian Civil War was in full swing by that point, but it was, long before our most recent presidential election and other such developments. Developed by a studio called 11-Bit Studios. They're based in Warsaw in Poland. And it is a war game, but probably not in the way you think when you think of a war game.
Exactly. So when I think of a war game, I think of running around with a gun and shooting people and taking cover occasionally so as not to get shot myself.
And I guess you can technically do those things in this game, but it's you might end up doing them once at some point, and it will probably end poorly for you.
Almost definitely.
Yeah. The game itself was inspired by the Siege of Sarajevo during the Bosnian War, which was in, oh, I'm going to get the date horribly wrong, but I want to say early 90s?
Yes.
I'm a terrible American when it comes to world events, I apologize. But so the Siege of Sarajevo and the Bosnian War was lasted 1,425 days, which is another one of those mind-boggling numbers to try and comprehend. That's, what, more than 3 years?
Right, so it started in the early 90s, but I think the siege didn't break until 1996.
Oh, man. Yeah, by that point, when you've transitioned from the mid-90s, or early 90s to the mid-90s, you know it's been a long time. It was the longest siege in modern warfare. And obviously, my memories of the Bosnian War are not crisp and clear, considering I was, I think, like ages 10 to 12 at the time this was going on. Did it make much of an impact on you at that point?
No, so let's see, 1992, I would have been 10 years old in fifth grade, and I guess the siege lasted until my freshman year of high school, almost.
Yeah, it's probably same here.
And no, I mean, I remember, you know, hearing about the Bosnian War, and I think Sarajevo would come up later in some pop culture songs, but no, I really don't remember learning much about this at all when it was actually happening.
Yeah, I have this kind of vague background knowledge of it. Like, I knew something was happening in Sarajevo. I think probably just because my parents had the news on and I heard it in the background. But I couldn't have told you anything specific about it. In fact, in the research for this episode, I probably learned more about it than I remembered previously.
Well, same. Yeah.
Yeah. So that was the inspiration for the game, although it is not technically set in Sarajevo or in the Bosnian War at all. It's technically set in the fictional city of Pogorin Grasnavia, which I'm probably mispronouncing, but I don't know if you can mispronounce a fictional city, or if I can just say that's how it's pronounced.
Well, I think we've proven that you cannot from our Papers, Please episode.
Oh, good point. Glorious Arstoka. Arstotska. Which I'm pretty sure must be the neighbor to Grasnavia.
Yeah, which, I guess if you had to pick, Chad, would it be Arstotska or Grasnavia that you would want to live in?
Oh, man. Well, let's see. In Arstotska, am I the border control agent or am I a regular citizen?
No, you are the guy who antagonizes the border control agents by handwriting his passport.
Oh, well, that's clearly the way to go. Because considering that means he has enough free time to make up fake passports and is pretty well supplied for himself.
Sure. So clearly Papers, game, Please is a utopia that we should all aspire to live in.
Yes. Like I said, glorious Arstotska. All hail. But in this game, you are somewhat less off than the guy with time to make fake passports and stuff. You have a group of 2 to 4 people, and you are basically taking shelter. You are not soldiers. You are not heroes of the revolution. You are regular people trying to survive. You have no idea how long this situation is going to last. Your city has been torn apart. You know, modern infrastructure has fallen away. You just want to make it from day to day. So during each day, you have to feed yourself and your companions and make improvements to your ruined house or shelter or whatever you're in. I think it varies a little bit. And then during the night, you have a choice to send one person out to scavenge other houses while the rest of your people either sleep and rest or stand watch against the looters that may or may not attack your house each night and take your hard-won possessions. And you don't have a lot of those possessions. You know, you're not a survivalist when this happens. You don't have your closet full of shotguns that you can go and pull out. Your house has, at the beginning, has a lot of, shall we say, improvised skylights in it.
Oh, holes.
Holes. Yeah, that's the term. Thank you. I was looking for that. A lot of holes in it. It's been pretty clearly bombed out. I think it still must have electricity because you have a refrigerator that your food is kept in, although that's never made entirely clear.
Oh, does it, or... I don't. Is it powered? I guess we have a radio that works eventually.
I guess you could keep your food in the fridge without power.
Huh.
Just for old time's sake. I don't know. So, generally, you got to... it takes on a little bit of almost a Sims vibe in some ways.
A Sims vibe?
Yeah, or a... but much less delightful in every conceivable way. as you know, you're trying to survive and not get stepped on by this war as it makes its way through your neighborhood repeatedly. So your goal is to find materials to build tools and weapons, keep yourself from starving. You might build things like a cooking stove so you don't have to eat raw meat anymore, or a rainwater collector, vegetable garden, a trap for mice. You can also build a still to make moonshine to trade. I think you can grow like an herb garden and start making your own cigarettes to sell on the black market. So you're basically trying to find a system so you can sustain yourself and your cohorts with as little outside resources as possible. How close did you get to that ideal?
Sorry, I was just picturing somebody browsing add-ons or expansions for The Sims, and they see, you know, Sims Nightlife, maybe Sims Civil War.
That's the one.
That's the one.
Although I've seen some playthroughs of The Sims that got pretty dark, honestly.
Well, fair enough. okay, so how self-sufficient did I get? Let's see, I think at one point I had a rainwater collector, and I had an improved stove, and
I never got the improved stove.
Oh, yes, you can cook food for less fuel.
Hooray.
Which I could get a lot of because I built a hatchet. And so I could chop up the old furniture that was in the house, but not my bed. I was a little upset with the game that once I made the hatchet, the game's default interaction with my bed was to chop it to pieces.
I had similar incidents, yes.
And then I had one or two mouse traps. Well, they weren't mouse traps. They were small animal traps.
Yeah.
But I kept them in the basement for thematic purposes.
The mouse is probably the most attractive option for what you're ending up with there.
Right. And I had the moonshine still. So basically, with the mouse traps, you use food and you use one food and you get two food back in a couple days. And then with the water, you can collect some of that every day. And so I was doing pretty well, I think. I just needed, you know, a few, I guess, outside pieces of food and some material to make water filters. And otherwise, I was in good shape.
And how many people were in your dwelling?
I had three.
Yeah, I think at one point I ended up with four, like someone else showed up halfway through the game.
Oh, yeah, I didn't play for that long. I had a former journalist who was good at bargaining. I think I had
I had her, yeah.
I had a football player who was good at running, and I had a guy that said he was a good cook, but I really didn't know what that bought me in terms of gameplay mechanics.
I think I had the same trio that you did.
Oh, yeah.
I looked that up later to see what good cook meant. He used less fuel while cooking.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Huh. Well, that's interesting.
On top of your improved stove.
I had to make the food just to make him feel better, to make him feel like he was contributing to the group.
If you read his bio, was it Bruno?
Yes.
Name? Yeah, Bruno was a former like TV cooking show host.
Oh.
And so I picture him just muttering to himself as he cooks food on the improved stove for less fuel.
For the longest time, I only had one bed.
This is a problem.
Well, I was able to like have everyone sleep in the bed on a schedule, so I was able to avoid making a second bed.
Yeah. I ended up with a pretty similar situation. I think once I discovered... Well, my first playthrough, which we'll talk about later, did not end so well. But once I discovered that you could build the rat traps, things got a lot better. Because you could, like you said, spend one food, get two back. It took a couple days. It was a little bit random. But I started building up a stockpile of that, which I was then able to trade and get some other stuff with. And I actually got a vegetable garden up and running. So
Was that worth it, the vegetables? It felt like a lot of work.
Well, nutrition is important, Brandon.
Oh, so. All right. Fine. Yeah. Thank you.
It was a lot of work for it. Essentially, once you have vegetables, you can cook that with your regular food and one meal becomes two meals.
Yeah, I saw like the two icons of a bowl next to the vegetable option. But I didn't know if that just meant it was a really good bowl of food or if it was actually two bowls of food.
It's actually two.
Yep. Oh, well.
But it also took a really long time to grow the vegetables. So I don't know if it was a wise investment. Right. But I put it up in the roof next to my little rainwater collector, and I felt good about it. And then everyone got sick, and it went downhill from there. So I got really good at self-sufficiency when it came to food and water. I boarded up the house pretty well, so looters weren't a huge problem. But then the medicine turned out to be my Achilles heel.
So despite all your supposed nutrition, Chad, all your people still got sick.
Well, imagine how much worse it would have been if they hadn't been eating their carrots. So if you're not growing your vegetables yourself or collecting your own rainwater, and there's some things you can't produce yourself, the only way to get them is to scavenge at night. You pick one of your people, send them out while everyone else stays behind. And so what happens in your shelter at night is it happens off screen, and you're only controlling the scavenging person. And some of the buildings you can go to, you can pick one per night, are abandoned. Others are inhabited by thugs you have to avoid and or fight, although I mostly just hid and ran from them. Or friendly people you can trade with, or people who are only friendly if you can trade with them. And perhaps innocent people you can choose to steal from, or not, or murder and steal from. The combination is up to you. And as you pick those buildings clean, it becomes harder and harder to find resources night after night. They don't auto-regenerate except in a couple of really rare circumstances that I've found that might actually be bugs. Did you ever prefer a place to go loot?
Yeah, I got a lot of mileage out of the very first abandoned house you go to. There was one location that I started to get rather upset with. It was the warehouse that had been taken over by bandits.
I don't think I had that one.
Because, well, this was like around day 10 or 11, and literally half the locations on my map were crossed off because of fighting, it said. I couldn't get there because there was unrest. So I had to go to the warehouse, basically. My choices at that point were, like, go to a house where innocent people are living and steal from them.
Yep.
Go to another house where more innocent people are living and steal from them instead. Or go to a warehouse and scavenge and try not to get shot by five bad people. So I chose the warehouse, and I think I ended up dying three or four times.
Yeah.
Because I wasn't good with the stealth and the combat mechanics of the game.
Yeah, and the save game function is pretty much non-existent, if I remember right. When you die, you start over again.
Yeah, that was frustrating for me because at first I didn't know when it saved my game. And I went to whenever I would go to leave the game, it would say, "Warning, all of your unsaved progress will be lost." And I would think, "Well, can you tell me what that unsaved progress is so I can make an informed decision about my choices?"
I started cheating the save system a little bit. I eventually figured out it saves at the beginning of each day.
Yeah.
So there were a couple times where something went terribly wrong at night, where I was like more than 2/3 of the way through the game at that point. I decided I'm not starting over, so I just reloaded and went through the day and the night again. I felt a little bit bad about that, but if it weren't for that, I don't think I ever would have finished the game, so.
Yeah. Yeah, I eventually figured out, yeah, it just saved the start of each day. Yeah, and every time I died at the warehouse, I just immediately paused and clicked to, you know, load my saved game.
Yep, exactly.
Then I just
Which, by the way, you were playing on PC, right?
Yeah, uh-huh.
I should mention I was playing on the PlayStation. There's some minor differences.
Ooh.
And so, you scavenge at night, you build your stuff during the day, and also while you're there during the day, most days someone will knock at your door. I think every 2 or 3 days you get Franco the Merchant, who stops by with his pack full of more things than you can ever possibly carry yourself, which got really annoying to me.
Yeah, Franco was helpful because, yeah, like you said, his the bag that you have only carries 10 or 12 stacks of things, and the rest, there's like 3 or 4 more rows that are all crossed off as if you can unlock them somehow later in the game.
That was my gut instinct too when I saw those were crossed off.
But I was reading the wiki for the game and it said there is no actual way to get a bigger bag, which made me very sad because that was one of my main reasons for exploring, was maybe somebody will give me a bag or teach me how to make a bag.
Yep.
Or allow me to carry 2 bags, please, anyone.
And some of the stuff doesn't really stack that much either. So if you have like 12 slots in your bag, one slot will only hold 2 pieces of wood.
Mm-hmm.
And wood is necessary for building a lot of things or making fuel for fires and cooking food and things like that. So I ended up relying on Franco for most of my wood supplies just because I was too lazy to waste my pack space carrying it back myself.
Yeah, I would save my pack space during my scavenging runs on the small but valuable items.
Yep.
And then, yeah, trade with Franco for the bulk materials.
Mm-hmm. Or sometimes instead of Franco stopping by, you might get neighbors who ask for help. They scenarios like, my wife has been shot by a sniper, come help me get her out of the street. Or it might be orphans begging for food. And in each case, you have a choice of whether to help them or send them away. So if it's the orphan, you would give them some of your food. If it's someone who's asking for your help, then one of your characters will actually disappear for the rest of the day. And I think they return the next day, not until then. And I never had any of them die while they were on those errands, but I would assume that that is maybe a possible consequence.
Yeah, I sent someone to help people at a hospital or something.
Yeah. And then sometimes, not every person you help, but I found that like a few days later, they would come by and say, hey, thanks for helping me out. Here's some stuff. And it was normally pretty valuable stuff that they would give you. So I think it was a net gain to help people overall, which might play into some of what the game was trying to say.
Yeah, I think so. We're going to talk about that in a bit, the procedural rhetoric of the game.
Did you tend to help people or kick them out?
Yeah, I tended to help them. Although when they came back and rewarded me by giving me their mother's earrings, I took it.
Oh yeah, me too. I wasn't going to say no.
I was also going to say that the pro strat we learned from Papers, Please of only feeding your family once every other day also carries over to yep. this game, I found out.
I waited until they got very hungry, and that was when they got to eat.
Oh, I see. Yeah, first I was trying to feed people every day, and that was just impossible. So
yeah. Yeah. And each day probably takes, I don't know, 10 to 15 minutes of real playing time to get mm-hmm. through. And it goes by really quick with all the stuff you want to get accomplished during the day. Cooking food, upkeep of your house, building new stuff, sleeping, resting, fixing, putting bandages on people, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
So in talking about what the goal of this little war of mine might have been,
there's no little, Chad.
I know, but I like it that way.
Oh, okay.
So, of this war of mine, their lead designer, who has, I apologize to him if he ever hears this, I'm going to terribly mispronounce his name as usual, but I think it's Mikhail Drozdowski, said that this war of mine was inspired by real life events and wants to deliver the message that, quote, this can happen in your city, in your country, according to an interview with him in PC Gamer. And I think that may be one reason that it takes place in a generic place instead of an actual like Sarajevo or anything like that. Or, it goes right along with a quote from the game trailer, war always happens on someone's doorstep. And so the game was released at right about the time that the whole like Russia-Ukraine thing was happening, where Russia was sending troops into Ukraine, and
mm-hmm.
The world was kind of paying attention to that. And so
right
I found
after
one
the Olympics.
Yeah, that's right. Right. Man, time goes by so fast. So I found one interview with a bunch of the development staff, which came out right when that was happening. And so in that context, one of the writers, Pavel Michowski, says, "We are not trying to make a political statement with our game. Even when we think about the current situation in Eastern Europe, I think I can speak for the entire company that we're thinking about ourselves and our families here. I just want our country to be kept safe." That's from a Polygon.com interview. And, by our countries, we're talking about Poland, where the studio is located, not too far from the events as they were unfolding, and with obviously a history with Russia that was relevant to what was going on. So I think, taking all this into account, the goal definitely seems to be to kind of point out that this could happen to you, this could happen anywhere, and, what would you do to keep you and your family and your friends safe in this situation?
Yeah. Although this is something I'm starting to believe more and more, is that no game is apolitical. Every game makes a political statement of some sort, from your traditional war games to your sci-fi shoot 'em ups to especially this game, I think. I'm wondering what in his mind he meant when he said he wasn't trying to make a political statement, necessarily.
I think maybe the key word there is trying. So I think is what you're saying, that, everyone brings their own biases and their own background to a situation, so it's unavoidable that something becomes politicized?
Yeah, every game you play is going to encourage certain types of behavior and validate certain ways of acting or people from certain backgrounds at times.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it's probably unavoidable. And there are, I think, clear political statements here, even if they were not consciously trying to put them in. So think about how...
The very first thing you see in the game says, F the war.
Yeah, that's right. It's right there on the title screen. Every time you load it up, there's the graffiti written in the background. So, yep, good point. So with keeping that in mind as the apparent goal of the developers, what were some things that you thought contributed well toward it?
Sure. So I thought that the immersion in the game was very well done. The production values were a lot higher than either of the games we had talked about previously, because this was closer to a AAA title, I think. The lights are very stark and dramatic, and with the accompanying shadows, and the background's illustrated with these rough charcoal pencil strokes to kind of accentuate the fact you're living in a gritty reality. There's some nice sound effects of gunfire in the background. I don't know that nice is the word to describe gunfire, but
accurate.
Hopefully you know what I mean.
Well-suited.
Yes, well-suited. Appropriate. Apropos. I apologize for using that word as well. And there's some nice, grim, dramatic music as well, which you can actually hear in the background of this episode.
Yeah, that was an element that kind of snuck up on me over time. I never sat down at the beginning and was like, this is amazing music. But it contributed a lot toward the mood of the piece in general, I think.
Yeah, I actually like the music in the warehouse, so that kind of eased the pain of getting shot in the face over and over.
Like, man, that hurts, but oh, there's an awesome soundtrack in the background. They got a good jukebox here.
And then something else I think that worked well was something called its embedded design. So we haven't talked about this term before. It's used in an article that was published jointly by the Human Computer Interactions Institute at CMU and the Tilt Factor Laboratory at Dartmouth College. And we talked about this, I think, briefly before in different terms, but basically this means not hitting your audience over the head with your message, which I think we all kind of instinctively know that if you make a game and you just plaster your intent and your goal over the front of it, the people will probably be put off by it a bit, or at least the people whose minds you want to change might not be influenced as heavily.
Yeah, the subtlety can be a better approach.
Right. So there's a couple ways the article suggests implementing embedded design. One of the ways is to alternate between your intended message and some more neutral messages. So I think one of the examples the article gives is like a card game where you would draw cards and you would have to react to the cards you draw. And some of the cards in the game had to deal with the theme of what the card game was about, which was, I think, gender roles. And then other cards just dealt with other social situations that were more neutral. So just seasoning the game with your message instead of, you know, unscrewing the salt shaker and dumping it into the stew is is helpful. Another way is by putting the message into a common game archetype. So in this case, the game archetype is the survival, not really survival horror, but just the basic survival archetype that you might see in Minecraft, for example.
Yeah,
where
that
you're
came
collecting
to
resources.
That came to mind for me, too, as I was playing it. You know, you start with very little, but with the resources to build some things that then let you build more things, which overall helps your survival.
Sure. And so they did some preliminary research on this theory, and it seems to be worthy of further investigation, so that was encouraging. Although when I described something like this to one of my friends, they raised the question of whether this approach was ethical.
Ethical. Ethical how?
So if you're hiding your message or your nefarious agenda within a game instead of on the surface of it saying what your message is that trying to brainwash people by stealth, for example?
Well, I think the ethics play more into what is your message rather than how you communicate it.
That's interesting. So for you, it's more the content of the message than the technique used to communicate that message.
I think so. I mean, you could take a message that you wholeheartedly agree with, but even if it's something I'm kind of pre-programmed to accept, if you beat me over the head with it, I'm not going to respond as well as if you're more subtle about it. Just because I'm going to get annoyed at some point.
Right, right. I thought it was interesting that this reminded me of actually an essay by J.R.R. Tolkien, who talked about the purpose of fantasy stories in particular was to I think, get past the glaze of familiarity that can accumulate over certain things and allow you to see things in a new way by, you know, getting past that kind of surface level shell that reality starts to have for you.
Well, yeah, just look at any episode of the original Star Trek series.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, certainly sci-fi. that's a great example.
It's sci-fi, not fantasy, but there were episodes clearly about racism and civil rights and all kinds of issues of the day, but dressed up in, you know, shiny future.
Right. Yeah, and I think also, you know, like I was saying before, I feel like every game has some type of message or political worldview of some sort in it. So I don't know that it's possible to make, you know, a totally neutral, I guess, bipartisan game in all cases. Any game you make of any sort is going to have something, some worldview embedded in it, right?
Yeah, I think you're probably right.
And in the case of this game, they chose to base the game on a 20-year-old event, and they're even fictionalizing that, so it's not actually technically set in the siege of Sarajevo, rather than in you know, the Ukraine, or, you know, in the Syrian civil war that was starting when this game was under development. So they're kind of distancing, I think, the audience's conscious mind from the message by, you know, putting it in a more, maybe less politically charged event of the past.
Yeah, something that maybe had some time to not be as fresh of a wound.
Yeah. So, yeah, I think that, and, you know, like we were talking about putting in the crafting mechanics and so on, that kind of engages the brain on one level so that it allows the message of the game to be absorbed in a way that might not be absorbed if you just said, you know, hey, civil war is bad. You should feel bad for people who are going through a civil war.
Yeah, which I think we probably would agree with without having played through the game. And some of the other mechanics I thought did a really good job of using the procedural rhetoric idea that we've talked about in past episodes. So, for example, it's more profitable to trade than it is to fight or steal things, and you can avoid doing the bad stuff if you have hard work and really plan out, you know, your supply runs and what you're going to build and things like that. For example, gunfights, you know, which are a mainstay of when you think of war games, are actually extremely risky here. Bullets are a very scarce resource. You don't start with any guns. You have to either fix one or build one from scratch. And, you know, you might have a half dozen bullets at any one time if you are extremely well-armed, or at least I never got above that level.
Well, I had 7 bullets, Chad.
What?
So.
Okay. Well, I bow to your... Well, did you end up with the whatever workbench let you build bullets?
No, I found them.
Yeah, same here. I just dug them up or traded with Franco. And actually, I never actively fired a gun.
I think I found them in a school, actually.
Yeah.
Oh, man. Well, that's another episode.
Yeah. But I never actively fired a gun during any of my playthroughs. I mean, so I mentioned earlier that the night stuff in your house happens off camera. And so some of my characters used up our bullets fighting off looters at night automatically, although I never chose to shoot at anyone. And part of that was because, you know, in the way I play any game, if there's a rare item, I never use it and end up with 12 of them at the end of the game. But I also just wasn't confident in my ability to do it effectively in a way that would not backfire, not literally, but that wouldn't cause events that would result in my own doom.
Yeah. Yeah, I tried taking the gun to the warehouse after I made one. And I finally figured out how to use the cover mechanics of the game. So I alerted one guy by accident. So then I tried to hide behind a box. And then, like, I put 4 or 5, like, all my bullets into this guy. And he was still coming at me. And then he shot me once with a shotgun. And that was the end of my life. So from that point, I decided that I needed to... make moonshine, not war, and trade it with people.
Can you replace the F the War slogan from the beginning with that one?
Yes. Yeah.
But also, if you do decide to go guns blazing and, you know, steal from everyone you meet and murder them, your characters become, quote, sad at first, and then eventually slide into full-on depression, and then their status eventually becomes something called broken. So all through that progression. They're, you know, they move slower, they complain more about their mental state, understandably, and eventually they literally stop functioning. Like, you cannot control them anymore. They will not get out of bed or just stand in your house doing nothing. And if you have other people in your house still, you might be able to talk them back off the edge, essentially, and, you know, give them food, spend a bunch of your day talking to them, get them some rest, things like that. They might come back, but they're still never quite the same again. And it takes a lot of effort to do so. And if you let that go unchecked, eventually the characters will kill themselves at night. You'll just wake up and I think one of mine like wandered off and was never seen again. And another one more clearly killed himself in the house after things had taken a dark turn.
So what did you do to your folks, Chad? That they...
I think that was the playthrough where I accidentally murdered a bunch of people.
What do you mean you accidentally murdered a bunch of people? How did you accidentally murder them?
I didn't. Okay, so I was still figuring out the mechanics, and I opened a box that I shouldn't have, because it turned out that was stealing, and I didn't understand that yet, or that I wouldn't have a chance to put them back or something. I don't remember. And the couple of civilians sitting nearby stood up and started beating me, and so I fought back, and I didn't have any weapons with me. I was punching them with my fists, and I didn't realize that would murder them. And
you sound like some superhero who woke up on Earth and you didn't understand your own power or what laws were.
I just blundered through the wall.
Yeah. Like some evil Kool-Aid man.
Yep. Hey, I accidentally took your stuff. Oops, you're dead. Sorry. I mean, all laughing aside, that impact of these events on your character's psyche is rare in games, especially in this genre of... you know, take things from other people, build things yourself as an option. Normally you can just do that and get away scot-free without too many consequences.
Yeah, I mean, I think in survival horror games, like when you're running away from Slender Man, for example, there is some degree of mental state that affects what you're doing. But yeah, I haven't really seen it in terms of a reaction to the morality of your actions as much.
I was surprised by the severity of the effects on the character.
Yeah, I mean, it's not like Knights of the Old Republic, Star Wars, where when you do bad things, you start to be able to shoot force lightning out of your hands.
Yeah.
No, in this game, you just get sad.
You get sad and take a lot of naps. And may or may not wander off into a war zone. So what gameplay strategies did you go with? I guess we've talked about it some, but you tended not to murder people, I assume.
Yeah, after my failed attempts at fighting the bandits, I just decided to, yeah, make moonshine and sell it for fun and profit.
I eventually started justifying my theft to myself.
Yeah.
So did you have the house with the elderly couple living there?
Yeah, that was when I really had no options for where to go. So eventually I went to that house and... You know, it would have been one thing if the elderly couple had just stayed in their living room and I could have just gone down to their basement and taken their stuff. But, like, the old guy would get up every time I opened the door and he would just watch me and say, I hope you don't steal my stuff. And I was like, oh, well, I can. And I just left. I think the only thing I took from that night was a can of tuna from, I think, his garbage can outside. And that was literally the only thing.
Which, that has to be, you know, their survival strategy of how they've lasted that long with no fortifications and a house full of supplies. It's essentially just nagging people until they go away.
Well, I really felt like, have you seen A Clockwork Orange?
Oh, a long, long time ago, yeah.
Where the quote-unquote protagonist and his buddies just leave the inner city and they go out to the country and they just home invade some innocent couple's home. I really felt like I was playing that guy and I couldn't, so I just took the can of tuna and left.
At the point I went to that house, I needed things a lot. I was out of food, I think, at that point. And so I justified to myself that I would take everything except the medicine. I left them their medicine. Because I think one of them says something specific about my wife needs her medicine or something like that. So I left that, but I took everything else.
So you left them the cure for hunger, which was medicine.
Yeah, totally. That's how that works. Yep. You can eat your bandages. But then later in the game, I found I regretted leaving that medicine there.
Yeah, because you can trade that for some good stuff.
Yep. And also all my characters were dying of illness. And at that point, I think there was increased fighting and I couldn't get back there.
Hmm.
So, I mean, so the morality did affect the choices I made in the game to some degree, at least. You know, I only stole some things from the elderly couple. As opposed to everything they owned.
You're only half a monster, Chad. Don't worry. Yeah. You can sleep through half the night.
But it did keep me from punching more people in the face accidentally most of the time. And so that's some of the things that have worked really well. And we also talked in the past about Dark Souls in a couple episodes about self-efficacy and failure and how that plays into or why you might play a game that you fail a lot. And this was a game where I failed a lot, especially early on. I'm not sure that was entirely due to the difficulty. It would come to some interface issues we'll talk about later. But it was not an easy game by any means, at least not for me. But I still kept coming back and kept playing it. And I think there's something there, and I can't quite put my finger on why that reason was that I kept coming back, but I did.
Yeah, the game wasn't quite as sticky for me, unfortunately. You know, some games like Dark Souls, you get punched in the face and, you know, you feel like you could have done something differently to not get punched in the face. Or you keep getting punched in the face in new and exotic ways, so...
Yeah.
It's fun to figure out how not to get punched in those cases.
See the city, meet interesting people, get punched by them. Yeah, admittedly, if I hadn't figured out how to circumvent their lack of a save game system, I don't think I would have kept coming back quite as much.
Mm-hmm.
As, you know, I think my one successful playthrough, quotes around successful, one of my people survived till the armistice lasted, I think, 47 in-game days.
Wow.
Or something like that. So, you know, by the time you're at day 44, if you die, I probably would not have started over at that point. So that was when I started, you know, cheating a little bit and reloading the save where you're not designed to be able to.
Yeah, I think, I mean, I got to day 12 before mm-hmm. I kind of started to lose interest.
Yeah.
Although I guess, you know, as we segue to, you know, what the game could have done a bit better.
Mm-hmm.
my first playthrough, I really didn't make it past the first day. Because I don't recall picking this necessarily, but I started as a little girl with her father. And the game started me in the shoes of a little girl, and I didn't know that I could switch characters to the father. I just thought playing the little girl forever. And all the little girl could do was wander around the house, and she couldn't really collect much or make anything. So I literally spent my entire first day making a teddy bear and then playing hopscotch upstairs. And it turned out that was not the best way to survive a civil war.
Well, see, we're learning things already.
Yeah. And then when the father went out to scavenge, I filled up his bag with all my stuff because I thought I would need the stuff in the bag.
Ah.
And that, you know, surely there must be something else for me to carry stuff in back or something. I don't know. So, yeah, I went out to scavenge and I couldn't carry anything back because my bag was already full. It was a rough first day.
Yeah, and the game didn't really make... Like, there is no tutorial or instructions beyond a very, very basic level that would tell you, hey, you can switch characters. Or, hey, you can do all this other stuff.
Yeah, I would have appreciated some... Just some very basic signposting of what I was supposed to do. You know, you literally just start and you're in a house. And you don't know that there's a day-night cycle. You don't know what you need to survive. You don't know what will affect your ability to survive if you don't do it. And I wish the game would have said, hey, you should really build a cooking stove. That's the first thing you should do.
Yep.
You built that. Good job. Now you're going to need meat and water and fuel. And here are some things that can help you get those. And here's how you can get more of those later. Just something just as basic as that would have helped me immensely, I think.
Yeah, a lot of other kind of crafting survival games do that a lot better. There's a tiny bit of flavor text buried in one of the menus where your characters kind of reflect on the state of their building. And on the first day, mine said something along the lines of, our house would be better if we had chairs. So I took that as, I need to build chairs. That's my goal for the day.
Sure.
So I spent my first day, you know, collecting what wood I could find around the house and building chairs out of them and eating raw meat. Because the flavor text did not say, oh, you should also build a stove to cook your food on.
Yeah. Yeah. And that was actually my second playthrough was I picked then three adults instead of a girl and her father. And I spent the first day building chairs and beds and trying to make a nice house. And and then everyone starved. So I had to start a third game.
And beyond conceptual things like that, some of the basic control mechanics are just completely opaque. So on my first night on that same playthrough, after I built all my chairs, filled up my house with furniture, made a little, war-torn IKEA shop. on my first night, this was before I accidentally stole and then killed people. The first time I accidentally stole from a civilian who then beat me to death while I tried to figure out where the punch button was. Because I literally could not figure out how to fight back.
Yeah, the combat was really strange. Like, I remember the first time someone tried to beat me up, like, all of a sudden I got a message saying something about war is not friendly. And then suddenly I had a health bar that was halfway depleted already.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, I wasn't quite sure what to do.
Mm-hmm. And if you're out scavenging, you have to, like, switch to your fists, which is an awkward mechanic, or any weapons you might be carrying. And even then, it doesn't tell you what button to use to trigger that weapon or fists. But like you said, there's also no guidance what to build, what you need, or even how long you need to survive. Which, that one, I could probably cut them some slack on. Because, you know, if you're in the middle of a war zone, you don't know how long it's going to last.
Yeah, that's true.
But that's one point of many where I thought they could have provided more detail. There's no hint of how scarce certain resources are, or even some of the mechanics around the items you find. So a couple of the luxury items that you can stumble on are cigarettes and coffee. And some characters are smokers and some are coffee drinkers, others are not. And I spent a long time after I found some coffee trying to figure out how to brew it. Like, did I have to use the stove? Did I have to, you know, build some other equipment first to get a coffee pot? Like, I could not figure out how to make coffee with the coffee beans that I'd found. It turns out your character just automatically drinks coffee.
Yeah.
Or automatically that confused smokes the cigarettes. Me as well. And every time my coffee drinking character got sad, I would say, oh, I should cheer her up by having her drink a cup of coffee. Like, if that's the thing she likes, that might help. But she's just drinking it every day anyway. So, and I only figured that out by looking at a wiki for the game.
Well, I would see in my little journal that I had drank so many cups of coffee or smoked so many cigarettes.
Oh, I missed that.
Yeah. So I eventually learned that it was somehow happening automatically. Although my confusion with coffee and cigarettes was when you would read the item description, it would say these things are currency in a war, cigarettes and coffee, right? So when I would find them scavenging, I would pick them up. And, you know, that was a big deal because I was using one out of my 12 bag slots to carry one cigarette when I could have been carrying like five or two logs, rather. But then I tried to trade them with what's-his-name, Franco. And he's like, cigarette? I have a million cigarettes. Stop wasting my time.
Yeah. There was one point during the game where, like, the black market shifted and cigarettes became really valuable for me for a couple days. But other than that, they were pretty worthless.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And there's some basic interface issues, too. Even when it does give you options, clearly, for what you can do. It was definitely designed for the mouse for playing on a PC rather than my PlayStation controller. So if someone comes to your door, you have an option to either talk to them or send them away. And it's two little tiny buttons right next to each other. And it's very easy to accidentally select send them away before you ever talk to them and trade with Franco or even have the option for, giving the orphans food and things like that. So I pretty routinely, like, people would knock on my door and I would basically tell them, go away.
Oh.
Because, by accident, totally.
Yeah, I used the Xbox controller when I was playing it on PC. And I figured out that the D-pad lets you choose between all the different actions that are available to you.
That's what it took me a long time to catch on.
Yeah.
So on another one of my early scavenging runs, if you approach a door, you have an option to open it or peek through the keyhole and see what's on the other side. And I accidentally blundered through the door because I didn't know how to pick the keyhole option. I thought I had it selected and it was into a room full of soldiers, and that did not end well.
Yeah, moving around was hard because it was very touchy. It was very touchy whether or not you were creeping along or blundering along, making lots of noise. So I would often end up, like, instead of quietly opening a door, like, running through it like a linebacker and throwing it open and, yeah, alerting everyone in the house.
Yep, pretty much. And then you know, I was playing it on my TV from across the room, so I had a really hard time reading the tiny text from my couch, which probably would not have been as much of an issue if I was up close to a PC monitor. But even the character bios, which have what little kind of flavor text there is or story here, I pretty much ignored them because it was impossible to read. And as a minor thing, again, like a typical American thing to say, but why was the temperature displayed in Celsius?
Oh, there's actually an option you can pick.
Oh, I missed that one too.
Yeah, yeah, so, yeah. You.
Because
I was going to say it was an upgrade you buy from Franco, but no, it's an option somewhere in the menu.
Franco sells you a calculator to, to figure out the conversion. No, because the temperature becomes important at one point when winter sets in and you have to heat your house with a stove to not die.
Right.
And I could never, you know, again, being an American and not fundamentally understanding anything beyond zero or is freezing in Celsius, I could never tell whether my house was a comfortable temperature or not.
Yeah.
But I'll retract that a little bit now, knowing that I could change it to Fahrenheit, but I did not even notice that.
Yeah. Yeah, so I think in general the flow curve of the game was kind of uneven, where, you know, it's very steep when you're figuring out the mechanics of the game and what your goal is. And then it starts to become like a nice steady slope as you're collecting things and improving your house and upgrading and so on. But then the cycle started to turn stale for me when I'd already planned out what I needed and I just had to wait until the next night to bring back, you know, 16 more logs to make a new stove or whatever.
Yeah, I don't know if the randomness of the game was structured differently for me, but I never felt that staleness quite settle in. So like every time I thought I hit that plateau of stabilization, something changed. Either winter set in or a crime wave swept through and it was harder to defend my house at night, or fighting would increase and I couldn't get to the place that I'd been planning on scavenging that I knew had the medicine I'd left at the elderly couple's house, or I just had more advanced things that I wanted to build and scavenge differently for. So I think there's different experiences depending on how the die rolls.
Yeah. Yeah. I think you and I had a different experience playing the game.
Mm-hmm.
But then, I mean, so looking at the summary effect of the game on us, you know, we talked in our previous episode about, you know, what's the call to action in the game. And, well, what do you think in this case? Was there really a call to action, or what do you think you were intended to do as a person after playing the game?
Sit around being glad that I live where I do in the time that I do. I don't know. There is no call to action built into the main game.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. I guess I felt more inclined to excuse that in this game just because, you know, I was playing it through Steam and it did seem like an actual, you know, more AAA video game title mm-hmm. than the other persuasive games we've played.
Yeah. And to be fair, they did, through an interesting model with some of the DLC, try to put a call to action, or not try to, they did put a call to action in. They released some downloadable content they called War Child, which added some exclusive street art that they'd commissioned from artists around the world to backgrounds of some of the locations in the game. So it didn't change the gameplay at all, but just the aesthetics of it. And all of the proceeds from selling that content went to a charity called War Child, which, as you might guess, works to improve the lives of children from, you know, Syria and other similarly war-torn areas. And within 3 weeks, they had raised enough money through that to help, they said, 350 children in the area.
Oh, wow.
So it's not built into the main game, but they did, at least briefly. Well, I guess they still sell it now. You could still donate. It's kind of interesting. You can choose how much to pay for it. You can buy the same DLC three different ways for $1, $10, or $20, depending on how much you want to donate.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was pretty effective in the sense that they raised a lot of money that way. But if you look at some of the comments on the downloadable content for sale on Steam, you know, they range from someone who said, "This DLC has more meaning to me than the 2016 presidential election," which I guess, you know, the game connected with them pretty well. But on the other end, someone said, "Supposedly it's for a good cause, though I couldn't have been bothered to read what it is that this charity does." So, I mean, they raised the money, which is good, but may seem to have had a, you know, anecdotally, at least based on these two reviews, a mixed success of raising awareness.
Yeah. Well, it's always going to bounce off some people, right?
Yeah, true.
But
I do commend them for making that effort. I just wish it was a little more integrated into the main game.
Sure. I think it also bears saying that sometimes a game can have an effect on someone even if they don't consciously know that it's had an effect on them, right?
Mm-hmm.
I guess the effect it had on me as we start to wrap up here, is that it was a generally powerful game, I thought.
I agree.
We talked a bit in our Final Fantasy 15 episode about how when your avatar resembles you and is visibly affected by what you're doing, your real-world behavior can shift to align with what that game is encouraging you to do. So, yeah, in this game, I was playing someone in jeans and a jacket, struggling to stay alive by cooking rat meat and vegetables, although not as many vegetables as you, apparently.
Well, we can't all have the green thumb.
And I was doing that with rainwater over a makeshift stove. And then at one point, you know, I paused the game to go eat lunch as an actual person. So I went downstairs and I pulled pasta and meatballs and mozzarella cheese out of the fridge so I could heat them up in the microwave. And I thought, wow, this is definitely a lot easier for me in real life.
Yep.
Than it probably was for a lot of people.
Yeah.
You know.
And even carrying what you said about, you know, how making an avatar look like you has an impact. That Polygon article I mentioned earlier talked about how the developers scanned real people for their character models. So they were essentially making their coworkers walk around the game, and that became extremely disturbing to them during testing and affected their play choices as they went through the game.
Yeah,
the,
wow.
The game's art director even refused to let his children be scanned for the child characters because he didn't want to see them get killed over and over again, quote, because I really think it could happen.
Yeah.
So, it obviously could not have quite that level of impact on us being not scanned in the game ourselves, but it was on the array of characters much closer to myself than a lot of games have, and that was definitely very effective to me. And I think after my first or couple of short disastrous playthroughs, I felt kind of underwhelmed by the game, but after embedding myself in it a little more and, you know, stumbling across the finish line with one person still alive, it's definitely stuck in the back of my mind, especially given light of current events that I see in the news.
Yeah, I certainly agree.
So, you know, sometimes we criticize people to sit around being more aware, but I think I legitimately am more aware of this and attuned to look for possibilities of what might happen with this kind of incidents in the future.
Certainly.
Yeah. I think we'll leave it there. You can probably find this War of Mine on whatever platform you have. It's on Steam, Android, iOS, PS4, Xbox. Give it a look, recommend it to a friend. To get a new perspective on what life might be like for a Syrian refugee and what they're trying to flee. Closer to home, you can visit us at unlockinggames.com for links to all the articles and everything else we talked about today, or let us know what you thought about this episode or how your playthroughs went for this game. But find us on Twitter at unlockinggames or on Facebook as well. If you have a social impact game you'd like us to look at, or if you're a developer of a social impact game yourself, we would love to hear from you. Drop us a line. Until next time, it's your move.